all across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Hey, great to have you with me. This is Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.org. We're glad to have you aboard. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programming that you're going to enjoy. You can always find out more about Veterans Radio at VeteransRadio.org or on Facebook. We post new podcasts every week, so there's new stories every week as well as our AM and FM programming. So keep in touch. Let us know what you want to hear. And we couldn't do this without the help of our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to nvbdc.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We're going to start with an interview done with Royce Williams, who recently received the Navy Cross for some heroics during the Korean War as a pilot. It was super secret for many, 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 many years, and only now is getting some recognition. Listen to this and you'll find out why it had to be kept super secret for over 50 years. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today, Navy Captain retired Royce Williams. Royce, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Now, Royce has been retired a long time. He's currently a 97-year-old California resident, and he is back in the news because his recently was awarded the Navy Cross for certain combat valor in Korea back in 1952 of all times. So let's start here, though, Royce. How did a nice kid like you from South Dakota, Wilmot, South Dakota, end up in the Navy for a career? I always get a kick out of these guys who live in states where there isn't an ocean anywhere nearby, but they go into the Navy and stay for a career.
Well, I was enticed by, I suppose, a movie, but I had an early flight in an airplane when I was four. I had a relative fly out of Fargo, North Dakota, for the Weather Service, which did amazing things with open cockpit biplanes back in that day, going to extreme altitudes for the equipment he had, 32,000 feet or such. And without communication and instrumentation, sometimes be above the clouds, and you would have to search for blue sky somewhere to get back down, often leaving him in Canada. But my brother and I both started early on thinking about what next, some years hence, and carrier aviation was a large part of the goal.
Well, it was certainly brand new at that time, and awful. It took nerves of steel to fly at that point. Was that a family trait as well?
My dad was World War I and one tremendous guy. I don't know. My early ventures were just kind of as a young wild man running around damming up a creek to make a swimming pool, pond, building wickiups, and fighting with swords following the Crusade movie. I had a lot of excitement and fun and freedom.
Well, you were looking for adventure, and you certainly found it in the Navy. As I said, he's a retired captain, so he retired out from that and did 70 missions in Korea and 110 missions in Vietnam. So plenty of miles and hours logged there, Captain Royce Williams.
I don't know if that adds up properly. I think my total combat missions were 227.
Okay, great. That's even better to get the record correct. So let's talk about the dogfight in Korea that kind of brought this back into attention after it was kept confidential for so many years. Tell us about this dogfight in North Korea with what I think was 7 Soviet fighters, and you shot down 4 of them ultimately.
Yes. We were rather new amongst the carriers to arrive in the Korean War. The Navy pretty much owned the eastern half of North Korea, owning responsibility. And it extended, of course, all the way to the Yalu River, which was the border between China and Korea, North Korea, and also a portion of it, Soviet Union and North Korea. And some of the juicier targets were a little bit out of our range and deserved to be hit to carry out our responsibility. So Admiral Jocko Clark, who was on the Missouri, designed a mission that we were on. And so the morning of the 2nd of November 1952, we arrived up off Cheonjin, a major city in North Korea, about 100 miles south of Vladivostok. And so being at that location permitted us to hit targets otherwise left pretty much alone. And I was on the first mission of the day in good weather and conducted strike against manufacturing and warehousing in the Horyong city, located pretty much right on the Yalu River across from the Soviet Union, followed by strikes from two other carriers. I was in the narrow wing on the Oriskany, but we also had two other carriers, plus maybe 20-some escort ships, including the Missouri, the battleship. And I'll cover it later, we had a cruiser, the Helena, that had an experimental, well, at least its first mission for the NSA, a team of experts in radar and communications with Russian-speaking personnel. But this strike, not only but for all three carriers, was pretty disturbing to the Soviet Union. We were close by bombing targets, and they got rattled and launched a lot of airplanes and a lot of chatter of the communications going on. So I arrived back from that attack and was notified to get a quick lunch and come back because I was going on the next combat air patrol.
Now you're a 27-year-old pilot at that point, right?
Yes.
I mean, this is flying into that space is was relatively new. And talk to people about the jet that you were flying, which today most folks wouldn't even know the name of.
Well, I was flying the latest in carrier of jet aviation for the Navy carriers. It was an F-9F-5 Panther, and it had capability of carrying external weaponry, bombs and rockets, etc. But it had internal guns of 420 millimeters in the nose of the airplane. And as such, we could seek a variety of targets. And though we had an air-to-air capability, our assignment was primarily air-to-ground of trucks and trains and any type of logistic problem, bridges and train tracks, and also close air support for our troops on the ground.
Well, that's what makes this dogfight with the MiGs so interesting in many regards. As you say, the Russians weren't real happy, the Soviet Union wasn't real happy with you guys flying that close on the first mission and striking some things, and then we get into the second mission, and they decide they're not going to let you go undisturbed. Tell us about that.
You're correct. We were not at war with the Soviet Union. We did not expect any threat to come out of this strike against North Korea. But on the other side of the river, people were making up their mind to evidently not let the United States get away with this. So I didn't expect any type of actual engagement on my combat air patrol mission. We were launching. By this time, bad weather had moved in, and we were facing a blizzard. And the ship was bouncing around quite a bit in low ceiling of clouds. And we launched and rendezvoused under 400 feet. And then we're climbing through the clouds with our direction and altitude control by our combat information center aboard the Oriskany. And in this climb through the clouds to on top of them at 12,000 feet, we were advised of inbound bogies, meaning unidentified airplanes headed toward the task force. So we were aware of that while climbing, and once on top and in the clear, we could see seven contrails headed directly at us. And these were coming directly out of the Vladivostok area, which was not very far away from us.
And we're talking to Captain Royce Williams, who recently was awarded the Navy Star for this upcoming dogfight. These seven Soviet MiG-15s fighter jets are coming your way. You start out with four planes in your squad. Two have to turn back because of some mechanical problems, and you and a wingman now have yourself faced with Soviet MiGs, which tell us a little bit about their maneuverability and air-to-air capability as compared to what you're flying in the Panther.
Well, at this time in history, this was the world's best fighter airplane. I had a great airplane in that it was Grumman Tough built and good capabilities within the limits not to match the MiGs in aerial combat. We didn't really expect to be combating them, but as it turned out, they chose to fight and it happened.
Yeah, you and your wingman were in that fight. I think I've read that it was about a 30-minute dogfight. Tell us what went on and kind of what's going on in your mind at that point.
Well, these contrails flew over us. They were extreme altitude, I would guess 50,000 feet at least. Once they passed over us, they turned back north, and I thought probably heading home. And I assumed they were Soviets out of Vladivostok. But I was instructed to climb to intercept if possible, if it came to that, but to be ready. And so I immediately charged and fired my guns and saw that all my fighting capability was ready to go. And my wingman and I climbed, keeping them in sight, and got to 26,000 feet. and they were by this time about halfway between us and Vladivostok. And they split into two groups and dived out of the contrails, me thinking they were probably going to go in the land. But I was wrong. And in short order, saw four of them in loose formation attacking me, and all of them firing.
Yeah, and then from the carrier, as I understand it, the original thought was, hey, just have the Navy jets protect the U.S. warships. And the commanders on the carrier thought, well, don't engage. The Soviets aren't going to engage. But all that thinking down on the ship was wrong, wasn't it?
Entirely correct, yes. I didn't expect them. I saw the airplanes, and once they flew over and I saw they were MiGs, I knew they were not friendly. So I was prepared for what eventually happened, but I didn't expect it. But when they came in and shooting, I knew I could not, should not run away, and I maneuvered rather hard and ended up right on in firing range on the tail of the number four airplane in that group of four. The other three were coming in from the other direction, so seven in the fight. But just fired a short burst of 20 millimeter, all four, and it started smoking and dropped out of formation. And at that point, my wingman chose to follow him instead of sticking with me. And I continued to trail the remaining three as they climbed abruptly, amazingly, with ease, well above me in reverse to come back and fire at me. And so while that was happening, I was going to fire at the number three guy that just lost his wingman, but I saw the other two, the lead of the whole flight of seven, heading directly in and firing. And I trained my weapon system on them, and when I thought they were in range, I fired a short burst, and that airplane stopped firing and did a turn off to the left while I noticed his wingman now in and shooting at me. And I now trained my guns on him and a short burst. And he quit firing and didn't maneuver and slid right underneath me, indicating to me that he was probably dead.
As you reflect back on this, Captain Williams, how much of this do you attribute to training, good luck, good equipment, or the grace of God?
Well, I'll put the influence of God number one. I was trained for this sort of thing, in that we were going to war, and our mission was primarily the support of our troops on the ground. We did very little in the way of training for air-to-air combat, but I had always had an interest in this, and on my own with my wingman did do some practice.
As this event unfolded, Royce, over the 30 minutes or so, I believe I've read you used up all the ammunition you had.
That's right.
And so this ended at the right time because you were getting out of ammunition, but this also was you took on a lot of shots. Your plane had something like 263 holes on it when it finally got back to the ship. Does that sound about right?
Well, yes, my plane captain went out with a grease pencil and circled each one and counted them, and that 263 is the number he reported.
I mean, the captain here used all 760 rounds of his 20 millimeter cannon shells on the on his airframe, and again, with the grace of God and training and good equipment, came out on the positive side of that.
Well,
but it wasn't over yet. You had to get back to the carrier. That was a little harrowing as well, it sounds like.
I realized that this flight took 35 minutes. A usual air-to-air flight is seconds or maybe a few minutes at most, and never one airplane against being so outnumbered. So this was a different type thing. I was there for a long time, and I fired only when I had gun solution in range, so I wasn't wasting anything. And I ran out of ammunition when I had an airplane smoking and it was descending, not maneuvering. And I think it eventually the plane that the pilot ejected from, and I'm sure was not recovered in time to save his life.
One of the interesting things, before I get about the confidentiality of this dogfight, go back and tell us about trying to get this back on the carrier because of fuel and holes in it and decreasing weather conditions. Tell us about that, because quite frankly, I can't imagine landing on a carrier.
Well, the MiG that hit me with a 37 millimeter, it exploded in the accessory section of the engine and destroyed the hydraulics, put the airplane pretty much out of rig, severed the cables to the rudder. So I was left primarily with an elevator, which gives you the capability of going up and down. It's very limited as far as turn. The guy that did that after I was hit, I happened to be pointed in the direction of the task force, and the clouds that were delivered the blizzard. This fight took place in clear air, but I headed for that, and the guy settled right behind me at perfect range to shoot me out of the sky, and I jammed the stick using my available elevators, which did work, and I would zoom up and then down, doing it as drastically as I could, which caused the guy to put a bunch of bullets over me, then under me, and then over me, and I just kept dodging and got lucky, and give credit to God on high. I reached the clouds, and they were very dense. I got in there, and we lost sight of each other, and my attention now came to think about how I'm going to get back aboard a carrier.
And that wasn't easily done in this situations. Both it took your skill, but the captain's skill on the carrier as well, to get you kind of lined up, because you didn't have all the normal controls you would have had for an aircraft carrier landing.
Oh, exactly right. I knew what the bottoms of the clouds are, so I carefully on my own descended under instrument conditions, and gave up the idea of parachuting because I wouldn't be rescued in time to save my life under the ocean conditions. So I arrived and coming in sight of the task force, and they were at general quarters, which means for those who are in the perimeter and have anti-aircraft capability, are free to shoot at anything that is unidentified. They feel it's a threat. And I hadn't been coordinated to where they knew I was a friendly, and unfortunately our ships fired at me. But my commanding officer had just been launched, really to be my relief and engage if it were to happen. Didn't happen, but that was the idea. And he saw what was going on and he got him to cancel firing. Well, then I just worked on studying my problem, seeing what I would have to contend with in the way of flight, and discovered that anything below 170 knots in the airplane would stall out. So having to work with two hands on the stick because of the out of rig condition of the airplane, I experimented to see what I could do in the way of control to get aboard the ship. So I kept my speed up, and when the aircraft carrier was ready to receive me, which meant that they had a lot of airplanes in the area where I'm going to land, but they were there preparing to launch another flight against Orion. So they had to clear all those out of the way because this was a straight deck, not an angle deck as we have the carriers today. They had to move it all forward. So when that was done and they gave me the signal, Charlie, meaning you're clear to land, I was somewhat in the right area to start my approach, which would not be a turning approach, which was the difficulty I had. So I was lined up, and then when the carrier was in the wind, and I'm talking to them about my speed, and they said any speed I wanted, because they had 30 knots available and that the ship could make in its own speed, and there was probably about that amount of natural wind in the storm. So they said, the captain said, bring him in any speed he wants.
Well, and let me explain that for the non-aviator types here, Royce. You couldn't get slow enough. You couldn't get your airspeed down to where it should have been for a normal landing. You were going faster than you should have, but accommodations were made, because if you stalled, if you went too low, the plane would stall out and plunge into this frigid ocean, and that would be the end of it. So you and the carrier had to kind of work together based on the condition of the plane to be able to get on board. And I read somewhere that the ship had to kind of turn a little bit to help line you up, because you didn't have, as you said, you had up and down control. You kind of didn't have side to side control. So they had to help out in that regards.
Yes, that's right. I was pretty much able to maintain the altitude control. But as far as lining, I wasn't able. And I told him that. And so the commanding officer of the carrier is a pilot, and he understood the problem. And as I got in close, pointing at the ship, but not lined up to make a landing, he turned the ship to line it up with me just as I needed it, and I made a pretty much normal landing.
Now, you caught the first wire then, right? Normal landing, you hit the first wire, all was good. Was that how it worked?
Well, the first wire was too low. We pinpoint to the perfect landing would be the third cross-deck pennant wire, and that's the one I did catch.
any stop's a good stop, let's face it.
You got it.
Now, again, there was no expectation that that the Navy would have to take on these Russian MiGs, and so this became kind of almost a I'll call it publicity, but that's probably not the right word, problem with, geez, we don't want to drag the Soviet Union into the Korean War. So the decision was made, I guess as this went all the way up to the Secretary of Defense and the President, that this dogfight had to be kept secret. And they explained that, I guess, to you right from the get-go.
Well, I wasn't dealing with people at that level at that time, but they knew about it right away and had great interest to fill in the blanks, and were trying to find out from the ship what happened. The ship didn't know what happened, but the people on the Helena, on the cruiser, had these people from the time they took off from their base until they said the remnant came back. And So they followed it all, but they were the only ones besides the Russians that really knew what was happening. But on our side, because they wanted information immediately, our intelligence officer, poor boy, had to make up a story, and it wasn't true. But I was told that our report, Admiral Briscoe, the ship, this was our last online combat for that period. We were about to go into a base at Yokosuka, Japan, and rearm, get the supplies, and for some of us to on our opportunity. Well, I was told to getting there as soon as possible, report to Admiral Briscoe, who was the senior naval officer of the Western Pacific. I did, and on arrival, I was guided to his office, and the door closed behind me, and greeted, and then he said, "Where did the Oriskany, my carrier, get that information, which was made public, which was not true, which the intelligence officer, under great pressure, made up?" He knew a little bit about it. They were in our ready room, which has a screen and information passed from our combat information center, but they had very little to report, and so he knew a fight was engaged, and he eventually gave in to pressure and went to the center on the carrier where the communications were set up with Washington, and made that false report.
Well, ultimately, you got debriefed, and as I say, it all the way up, I understand you had got to get meetings with or interviewed by, however you want to put it, not only a bunch of the admirals, but the Secretary of Defense and also the President Eisenhower. All along the way, they're saying, hey, we don't want to pull the Soviets into this, keep this classified, and it was classified for some... Geez, what are we at now? Almost 70 years or something. And in 1953, a year later, you received the Silver Star for this engagement, although it only mentions three kills. The fourth wasn't known until Russian records were released in the 1990s, apparently. But how does a young hotshot pilot who's going to have a long career in the Navy and reach the ranks of captain, how do you keep this secret?
Well, I was told, and I obeyed. And it was a bit of a problem because I knew what was being said about the whole thing was not true. And, of course, it would have an influence on my career if they knew the facts and it became well known, whereas it was more or less a brief moment in time, not true, and more or less forgotten.
Well, and you kept this secret not only professionally but personally. I understand only after it was declassified and after some efforts to increase the recognition from a Silver Star to maybe as high as a Medal of Honor, but ultimately settling on the Navy Cross. Did you get an opportunity to tell this whole story to your family, including your wife?
It's true.
Yeah. Did they believe it, or did they say, "Oh, Granddad, oh, Dad, we know you're just telling another fib"?
No, I just told my wife, and she was more or less shocked, and her comment was, "Oh, Royce." That did it.
Well, it's probably better she didn't know and worry all those years about the next mission, because you flew a lot of missions after that as well.
Yes.
You spent a long career in the Navy and serving the country, and obviously now you've had a long time to be in retirement and enjoy that. What did you learn from that experience of testing yourself in North Korea that maybe you'd pass on to other people as a little pearl of wisdom?
Well, I probably learned what I would have had it not happened, so maybe sharpened the learning experience. I was a professional and dedicated, and whatever the mission, I think I always tried to do my best. We still had a lot of war ahead of us, and it was different, but in support of the troops and all, it was important.
Yeah, and I think today sometimes we don't hang on to some of those rock solid values, like doing the mission, being a professional, living up to your word. If you're told to keep it confidential, you keep it confidential. Those are all good lessons for everybody to learn, even today, I believe, don't you?
Yes, of course. And of course, it deepened my faith in God.
Absolutely. I do want to ask, after all these years, and I know there was some effort to get it upgraded to the Medal of Honor, just this year in 2023 here, you've received the Navy Cross. Talk to us about what receiving this second highest award for valor in combat felt like to you, and what you think it symbolizes.
Well, I had been teased with the Medal of Honor, and when it didn't make it because of a turndown in the Senate, my congressman got in touch with the Secretary of the Navy, who miraculously came out and visited with me for about an hour and a half and came well prepared to have his questions answered. And he went away believing there had been a miscarriage in justice, and he had the authority to correct that. And in very short time, a few weeks following that, he made up his mind that the Navy owed me a higher medal, and he saw to it in a wonderful ceremony. It was just amazing. It would have made a lot of difference. It would have made quite some difference in my career, I imagine, had I been given that credit while I was on active duty. But was not so. So whatever happened after that time had to be based on the circumstances and the performance at that time.
No, and there are many stories of valor that probably should get the nation's highest award but don't for any variety of reasons. But I always think it's important to get recognized on these sort of things, like for the Navy Cross, so that your larger community, whether that's your where you live now, back in South Dakota, the family, other naval aviators, so that the larger community can share in that recognition. And based on what I saw from the ceremony, there was a lot of community support and recognition for the Navy Cross ceremony. I think that must have felt really positive for you.
Well, yes, indeed. I had a lot of friends out in the community at the event, and quite a few that I did not know, but they were all supportive, and I've had follow-on conversations where it seemed to mean a lot to them. Probably not as much as to me, but it impressed a lot of people. And with that, our lessons, you think about what you learned, if it seems to make an impact. And there were active duty personnel there, and they're not knowing what they're facing, but who knows? They may call upon it, and if this means anything to them, they'll be as prepared and in the best equipment that their country has for them. So they may get their turn.
Well, I also got to say, Captain Royce Williams, you were, are undoubtedly, at 97 years old, the best-looking captain in uniform for that age.
You lie.
So I'm sure it was fun to be with all those folks who are actually looking up to you. They're not your peers. They're all younger. They're all from a different era, but looking at you, going, man, there's a man's man. There's an aviator's aviator. And again, well deserved. The story was untold for over 50 years. So we're glad, Captain Royce Williams, that you got a chance to receive the Navy Cross and tell a little bit of this story to our listeners here on Veterans Radio.
Well, I'm pleased to do so.
Well, you don't get to talk to a 97-year-old Navy Cross recipient, hero pilot, really quite a dogfighter. So we ran a little long. I appreciate you listening in for that whole thing. Let's have a few more words from our sponsors.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Well, we have a special program here on Veterans Radio today. I want to bring on Army veteran Mark Aldridge and VA doctor, Dr. Kishore Patel. We're going to talk about some therapies and approaches used by the VA today. That might be something you haven't bumped into before, but maybe you should, and that involves acupuncture and whole health. So, gentlemen, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, Mark, let's start with you. You've been on Veterans Radio before. We're talking to Mark Aldridge. He retired from the U.S. Army in April of 2021. He's now 100% rated disabled veteran by the VA after three combat tours over a 14-year period. And we've had him on before actually to talk about his business. He's an entrepreneur. He has two entities, one called J-Dog Junk Removal and Hauling and Demolition in Plymouth, Michigan, and also just started J-Dog Carpet Cleaning and Flooring Care in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Lured me into this topic. He said, hey, have you ever talked about anybody who's got acupuncture before? So why don't we start there, Mark? Explain to us what medical conditions kind of brought you to, hey, I'm willing to give that a try.
Well, Jim, it all started out a few years ago. I had filed a claim for some neuropathy and plantar fasciitis. And the claim had actually got denied. And so I resubmitted, and part of the final approval process was going to final all-end CMP exam. And that was with Dr. Patel. And so once I got to the CMP, I was kind of nervous. I didn't know which direction this was going to go. And Dr. Patel and I started just having a conversation. He looked at the documentation and he goes, I don't quite understand how this got denied. All the documentation, the paperwork is there. There's clearly an issue. And as we were talking, I was telling him about some of the other issues and some of the other ratings that I had for other disabilities. And he was kind of looking through it, and when we were talking about my back, my neck, other issues with my knee, and just overarching disabilities that I had, he kind of mentioned, well, I'm currently doing this program, this battlefield acupuncture, that you'd be a good candidate for. Why don't you reach out for a consult, and let's see if we can relieve some of that pain. So about a month or two went by. I had reached out, done a consult, and had my first therapy session. And within seconds of first needle going into my ear, I had relief. And it took my pain that was normally around 8, 9, sometimes even a 10, down to a 3, 4 in that first process. When I got up from first treatment, my gait had not completely cleared up, but my gait on how I could walk was substantial in just being more pronounced and not having to kind of walk with a limp and shrug over all the time. So that's how I kind of got involved. And so we did this for probably with the battlefield acupuncture of the ears for about maybe 6, 8 months. And as we were talking through at our sessions, he said, I'm also doing full body acupuncture. Why don't we try and focus on some other areas and try this out? I really do not like needles, so I'm very skeptical also about holistic approaches. I don't like the needles, and so I said, all right, let's give it a try. I'll suck it up and let's try it. And we've been doing this ever since with the whole body, and it's just helped me dramatically. My pain management has gone down from a 2 or 3, from an 8 or 9 down to a 2 or 3, and I can go weeks, if not a month or more, without having another session and having a low pain ratio. And I'm a big person that kind of has an addictive personality, so I didn't want to go on pills and be subject to every day taking a pill and still having that same amount of pain. This was an opportunity that I can now have less pain and I don't have to take pills.
Well, let me bring in Dr. Kishore Patel here. He got his medical degree from Ohio State University College of Medicine. He has been practiced for more than 20 years now. He's an internist in Ann Arbor at the Veterans Affairs Ann Arbor Healthcare System. And first off, doctor, it's hard to get testimonials like that from big, strong veterans who cry when you put a needle by them. But you can tell us how you got involved in looking at acupuncture as a possible method for pain relief and symptom relief.
Yeah. It's been a kind of a fascinating course. You know, my background has always been strong in the sciences. My undergraduate was biochemistry and chemical engineering and very much steeped in the sciences. But what was unique about the way that I was raised, I had of this Indian heritage, even though, I grew up partly in England and partly here, they very much steeped in Ayurvedic medicine. So looking at kind of the holistic kind of approach. And so that's always appealed to me. And even in my traditional practice, I've always recommended plant-based foods that decrease inflammation, and discuss that. In 2016, we received a grant to, the VA received a grant, the VA, to try to implement other ways to kind of manage pain. And one of the approaches was instituted by a person that was named Nogier is the original guy in France who developed this kind of map. But we also had Dr. Nimnitz, who was part of the Air Force acupuncture division, and he had developed a quick approach to helping as many veterans as he could, and we labeled that as something called battlefield acupuncture, or BFA, right? BFA. So, and the term, even though it does involve needles, and there is the five general points But the goal was to try to decrease as much pain as we could in our veteran population. And as Mark pointed out, you know, he wanted to avoid medication, which is true for many of the veterans that we see. They want to decrease medications. They definitely don't want to get dependent on them. And of course, that was a little bit at the height of that opioid awareness, right? And we wanted to decrease the number of opiates also. So anyway, that was in 2016, and I trained with his group, and we learned about the battlefield acupuncture, and then we kind of implemented it at the VA. So really, since 2016, we've been having these clinics. But not a lot of advertising, not a lot of veterans, a lot of just word of mouth, and we had brochures, and I think people would sometimes look at it and go, oh, this involves the ear. But it really is the ear in terms of acupuncture. You know, we have in acupuncture, we have something called microsystems, and so, you know, people are familiar with scalp acupuncture, hand acupuncture, foot acupuncture. Well, the auricular or the ear is also very rich in terms of signals from the brain and controlling areas of pain. And you can see the whole body represented. I think I've shown Mark this map of the ear and all the points on there that could help with pain. So in Ann Arbor, we actually took it to another level. So we started off with the BFA, and we still have the regular BFA clinics, but we also instituted, which Mark was part of, something called the auricular acupuncture clinic, okay, which actually was more targeting different body parts, different body points of pain with that representation of the body on the ear and targeting very specifically areas that were causing discomfort for the veteran. So we instituted that a little bit after starting the BFA and with the training as a medical acupuncturist. So a medical acupuncturist or an acupuncturist is allowed to do more than just the BFA. We were able to institute these auricular acupuncture clinics, and then added to that, which Mark was also part of. So Mark was kind of what was
somebody,
interesting about
somebody's,
Mark was,
somebody's got to be the guinea pig, Dr. Patel, and obviously Mark Aldridge was just the right guy for that.
Well, he's not unique enough. Probably about 80% of the veterans we see do get some benefit in terms of the pain relief. But what I was going to say is that he kind of went through that transition. So he went through the BFA, then he was in the auricular where we were targeting, and he will tell you this, we were targeting areas for his neck and shoulder and then the knee and the low extremity. And we were doing that on the ear, and he was getting tremendous, you know, benefits to that. And then we added the whole body. So BFA, which is just 5 standard points to mitigate pain, then you can go to the next level, which is an auricular acupuncture clinic, which involves all the body parts. And so you can target very quickly, you know, a veteran population that may have pain in multiple areas. Sometimes they can't always get up on the table and be in certain positions, you know, for the whole body acupuncture, but they can still get tremendous relief of their pain. And then expanding that to also incorporating whole body acupuncture at Ann Arbor. And we've been doing those clinics now for at least a year. We've got 2 medical acupuncturists. We've also hired 3 other acupuncturists that are coming on board, 1 in Canton, 2 here in Ann Arbor. Actually, I'm sorry, 4. 1 we're going to hire for Toledo. So tremendous opportunities to help veterans with their pain. And really the BFA or the standard initial, we've trained many of the nurses also to do that. In fact, I just trained a whole bunch of physical therapists to do that. I trained physical therapists in Toledo that can institute these 5 points, which have really good landmarks. They don't have to be acupuncturists, and they can just do those focus and help veterans with pain.
So that's pretty interesting about how VA has moved into acupuncture for pain relief and some other whole wellness issues. Our interview with the doctor and Mark Aldrich goes on much longer. You can find it on our Veterans Radio podcast. If you go to veteransradio.org and search for it, you'll find more if you'd like to hear more. Before we run out of time, I want to thank VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System for its continued support of veteransradio.org, as well as our VSO sponsors, Vietnam Veterans of America, Chapter 310, Graf O'Hara VFW Post 423, and the American Legion Irwin Prescorn Post 46. Again, you can't do this kind of programming. We're coming up on our 1,000th program. We're going to celebrate it on July 9th. We're going to have a little party in the parking lot at Wham Radio on Packard Road in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Come on out about 4:30 that Sunday. We'd love to have you. So stay tuned. Thanks for listening in. I'm Jim Fossone, and until next time on veteransradio.org, thanks for listening in. I hope you enjoyed Navy Cross recipient Royce Williams and the story on acupuncture. Always something interesting on Veterans Radio. We're glad you tuned in. Please do so again next week at this time. Join us for the 1,000th show on July 9th. And have a great week, and until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.